tasseled white cap, hiding her sleek, straight hair, enhancing the simple beauty of her large, dark eyes. She filled and refilled water tumblers, filled the sauerkraut dish twice, and made sure the dumplings were moist and hot. She brought out a chocolate cake, loaded with walnuts ground to slivers and topped with crumbly brown sugar. She served applesauce and golden pears, glazed with honey. Helen looked up from her plate and watched Hester intently.
"Emma, your Negro is light-skinned. Is she a mulatto?" she asked, watching her friend shrewdly.
Emma's face was kind, soft, and benevolent, the steel beneath her skin well hidden. Her remark was courteous as well.
"Why, yes, Helen, she is, in fact, of mixed origin. I believe they said Jamaican when I bought her at auction."
"But,"
Helen spluttered, wrestling with curiosity,
"I had no idea Enos was so well-to-do that you can afford a servant."
Emma batted her short lashes and lowered her eyelids humbly.
"Oh, Enos was a man of means, indeed he was, but so modest, so very unassuming."
This remark set Helen directly on the path of acquiring a girl to serve her food, no matter what the cost. Never once did she imagine that Emma had taken in an Indian, the way some people claimed. Why, she was so well-to-do, she had her own servant. But then look at the way that woman has given, casting her bread upon the waters in more than one area. God rewards people like that, she told Rufus. Walter Trout took one bite of the chocolate cake and figured it was among the best things he'd ever been fortunate enough to taste. He watched Hester's impeccable manners, her quiet serving of this delicious meal, and wondered if he could possibly be called to Sunday dinner more often, even when they'd be living out in the country and all. His warm heart felt a great longing to erase the sadness from the young girl's eyes. He looked forward to being able to sit at Emma Ferry's table again. Billy watched Helen Dienlinger's face turn steadily darker, her breathing light and quick as she consumed her cake, and thought how much she looked like a catfish after you take it off the hook, gasping for air the way they did. Chapter 9. It was in April, when every street in Lancaster had turned into a slick brown quagmire, the showers replenishing the soupy mess almost every day, that Emma hired a boy from the livery to take them out to the country to see the new home. She was worried about Hester, so lifeless and thin. She had no appetite and said very little. Even Billy could not get her interested in anything. When the carriage pulled to the door, Emma hustled both Hester and Billy out, shooting uncomfortable glances Walter Trout's way. He had hinted broadly that he could accompany them, seeing as how he owned the property and all, but Emma said there was no need, they'd be fine, and dismissed him easily. He watched them go through an open curtain, then thought perhaps it was best that they go without him, since the carriage looked pretty narrow. Emma heaved herself into the carriage, taking the livery boy's hand as an aid. She meant to touch it lightly the way the younger ladies did, filled with grace, but she pushed down on the slight boy's hand so hard he had to hold it up with his opposite one. His face grew red with exertion, and he considered himself extremely fortunate to have any room at all beside her on the front seat. Emma did think that if the time ever came that Walter would accompany them to the country, they would need a sturdy wagon, not a weak carriage. They made them so flimsy these days. She set her hat squarely on her head and tied the thin scarf down over it securely beneath her one soft chin, then sat back to enjoy the ride. The air was wet, filled with scents of rain and standing water and dripping new plants that seemed to be bursting with happiness. The sunlight was weak, but getting stronger each day, holding the promise of heat and humidity, a coming season of plenty. They passed the wheelwright's shop, a row of houses, and the livery. Soon they could smell the open fields, the forest, the clean new grasses that waved and bowed by the muddy roadside. Their progress was slow. The horse lowered his haunches and leaned into the collar, pulling the carriage through the ruts made by all kinds of traffic. Hester sat in the back seat, her face hidden by the broad brim of a large blue bonnet an old one of Emma's who had carefully adjusted it to hide the color of her skin. Beside her, his new straw hat pushed to the back of his head, Billy hooked an elbow over the back of the carriage, whistling and warbling and chirping to his heart's content. His blue eyes followed the soaring of the birds, the way they dipped and wheeled in the blue sky, smudged by streaks of white clouds. Hester asked if he knew the fishbone clouds, the ones that appeared in the east when a good rain was coming the following day.
"You can't go by that," he said airily.
"Sure you can."
"Nah."
"So tell me how you can predict rain."
"Go out and see if it's raining. That's easy."
Hester laughed. Emma turned, so glad to hear this sound. Hester smiled at Emma and said there would be so much she could teach Billy about nature, the garden, the herbal medicines she prized. Emma said probably not just Billy, but her as well. Their first view of the house was a disappointment. It was in lamentable shape. A moth-eaten dress that looked suitable from a distance, but the damage clearly visible as they approached. Emma almost fell out of the carriage in her eagerness, while the boy who brought them stayed sitting in the exact same spot. There was no way he was going to put his life in danger to help this lady down. Emma rushed to the front door, her small feet pattering across the wet grass, giving the illusion that she was floating, as if wheels propelled her smoothly along. The door was attached by only one hinge, allowing creatures access to the house. By the looks of it, plenty of them had taken up residence. The rooms were filthy, the kitchen black with smoke.
"Now how can this be? Walter said there was a couple living here, but they couldn't afford the rent."
Emma's voice was thick with despair, almost a whine. Billy had spied a snake already and was off across the wet grass. Hester stepped through the door, turned her face left, then right, sniffed, wrinkled her nose, and pronounced it livable. There was a fairly large kitchen in front, the first room of the house. Half of one wall was filled by a vast fireplace, a wide beam placed across the top, the stone and mortar disappearing into the ceiling in the middle of the house. The floors were oak planks, wide and sturdy, but littered with rodents' waste, bits of nutshells, grass, dead flies, and other insects. The sitting room took up the whole left side of the house, a tiny circular stairway going out of a corner of it to the upstairs. There were only two bedrooms. The ceiling was the underside of the oak roof shingles. Everything was covered with the remains of free, scurrying mice and rats. Likely mink, otter, opossums, and skunks, too, Hester thought.
"Let's just stay in town."
Emma's voice carried genuine tears, ill-concealed.
Do yay,
she kept lamenting. Hester said nothing. She realized her position as the person who was the recipient of this kind woman's charity, and didn't wish to appear bold. Her whole heart longed for this space, the fields and grasses, the trees and water, clean and fresh and free. She wanted to stay here in this unused dwelling, away from the fear that dogged each day, the feeling of being stalked, her spirit repressed, unable to go outside and smell the scent of the town. Without that, the very atmosphere seemed secondhand, as if the air had already been breathed by someone else, and her allotment had been spare. Emma had started on her other excuses, reasoning that at her age there was no sense in working like this, and she was fairly certain that fat Walter Trout wouldn't lift a finger to clean this place. Hester thought of Kate saying, "The pot shouldn't call the kettle black," but said nothing. Quickly, Emma shot out, "Hester, what do you think?"
"I want to stay. Please, can I stay here? I'll clean. I'll do everything. I don't want to go back."
Emma's eyes widened, popping in surprise.
"You do?"
"Yes. Oh, yes. I love it here."
She swung her arms toward the surrounding hills, the grasses heavy with good moisture, the soil beneath it so rich, so fruitful. She explained where a garden could be made, a horse and wagon kept in the adjoining barn, a fence built for a pasture, perhaps in time their own plow, more than one cow, a nice flock of chickens. When the doorway darkened, Emma lifted a hand to her mouth, her eyes wide with fright. She squeaked helplessly. Hester stayed still, her back rigid, without looking. It was best this person did not see her face.
Hello?
The voice was deep, with a demanding quality. Emma's chin wobbled a few times before she could speak.
Yes, hello?
I was riding across the field and saw the carriage parked by the barn. I was curious, is all.
Oh, of course. Emma stepped forward, her natural goodness of heart shining as usual as she thrust her plump hand in the general direction of the tall, dark man. He bent to take it and shook politely.
I am William. William King.
Emma Ferry. Enos was my husband's name.
The cheese peddler?
Why, yes, he was a peddler. Cheese, yes.
Delighted, Emma gabbled away like a silly turkey being chased by its peers. Recognizing her words had no merit had she not been connected to Enos. The tall young man was very good-looking, Emma summed up, and she was always a bit tongue-tied around Zeli Gut Gukashi. This one might be Amish, though, since he was wearing those wide suspenders and that flat-looking hat. He lifted his chin in Hester's general direction.
And her?
Hester. You mean our Hester?
Too late, Emma realized her mistake. Hester moved swiftly. Like a wraith, invisible, she melted away through the half-open back door. William King's face blanched. He looked as if he had, in fact, just encountered a Spenz.
Who? What is her name?
His eyes were terrible in their intensity. Emma's plump, pink hand went to her throat to still the fluttering.
It is Hester. Hester Zook?
No.
In a few long strides, he pushed Emma aside, tore through the door in the back of the house, and lunged down the steps.
Hester heard his name. She heard his voice. All her own shortcomings, the color of her skin, Hans, her past, rose directly in front of her, roared and crashed and clawed their way past any hope of meeting him again. She could not look at him. He must never see her. She ran, lifting her skirts. The rush of air caught her hat, swinging it off her head. It hung by its wide strings, flopping, bouncing like a terrified bird, a parody of her heart. She increased her speed when she heard strong footsteps behind her.
Hester, wait! Wait!
She looked back, wildly.
Please stop, I just want to talk.
On she ran, determined that he must never see her. He overtook her, then reached out and caught the flapping bonnet. She slid to a stop, her chest heaving, her hands balled into fists.
Hester. Oh, Hester.
The words were a caress, a coming home, a believing of the impossible, the accepting of a miracle.
Don't.
She whispered the words harshly, her eyes downcast. She would not lift them.
Hester, it is you.
She felt his nearness, heard his breathing.
Look at me, Hester.
I can't.
Try. Please try.
What kept her from allowing him to see her eyes? All the shame of her past, the greedy, clutching self-loathing that choked her and tamped down her eyelids. She felt his strong, calloused finger reach out and lift her chin. Hester, he whispered. Tears squeezed through her closed eyes. She caught her lower lip in her teeth to suppress the emotion.
What is it?
He whispered.
I am not who you think I am.
Who are you?
Her eyes opened, revealing black liquid pools of pain and uncertainty. She saw the tall, dark form, the black hair cut squarely across his forehead, falling below his ears at the side. She took in the blue of his eyes, the chiseled nose, the perfect mouth.
I ran away. I am with the English.
The disappointment that darkened his face was hard to watch, so she lowered her eyes.
Why?
He grated.
You remember the wedding?
He nodded eagerly.
Annie didn't like me. It didn't work out.
If I remember, I warned you.
Yes.
Emma was walking toward them, her calling reaching their ears. For a long moment, he drank in the face kept alive in his memory. So much as he remembered, and yet so different. Fear clutched at his heart. Why had she left?
What had she done? Emma's short form was so unwelcome, William King had to visibly rearrange his features to accommodate her breathless appearance. Fat little Gwunda knows.
Oh.
Emma's voice made puffing sounds like a small, fussy locomotive.
Hester, my love.
Stopping, Emma looked from one face to another, her sharp eyes boring into the mask of impatience across William's, the raw despair in Hester's, a vulnerability that brought sharp words of rebuke to her small red mouth.
Mister, you are upsetting Hester. You should not have run after her this way. She has been through an ordeal. Now you just go easy on her. I mean it.
His anger was ill-disguised. It rippled along the muscles in his cheeks, turning the brilliant blue of his eyes a shade darker, an orange flame appearing only 1 second before evaporating.
Oh, I didn't mean to upset Hester. I am not aware that I did.
Oily words. Emma was quick with her tongue.
Then I would suggest you leave her alone.
William drew himself up to a magnificent height, his eyelids falling to a level of condescension he was accustomed to exercising over his peers. He cleared his throat.
Hester and I have met before.
Really?
Emma's tone was flat and as uncompromising as a stone wall. Hester became agitated. A hand went to her throat.
William King and I met briefly at my father's wedding. He does not know my story.
If you will please allow me to continue my conversation, perhaps she can tell me in her own words.
Oh, no, she ain't. You want to talk to my Hester? You ask her if you can come calling like any gentleman. And for now, we will be busy, too busy, in fact, to have you around.
Before he could reply, Billy popped out of the high grass, his gray hat pulled down so far he didn't appear to have a face, only an opened collar and a chin.
Hoo! He yelled. Frogs ain't easy to catch!
He tilted the grimy hat back out of his eyes, releasing a curtain of copper hair, sized up William with his blue eyes and blurted, "Who are you?" William's smile was genuine, his white teeth lighting up his face as he bent to extend his hand to Billy's, grasping it firmly with a solid shake.
"William King, nice to meet you."
"You too."
Billy wasn't used to meeting men, strangers, that were 10 feet tall, he guessed. His hand felt as if it left the wrist it was attached to, but he figured it was still in working condition once William King let go of it. Together, they walked back to the house. William did most of the talking, with Billy injecting his flow of words with boyish remarks. Emma's face looked like a thundercloud, her eyes snapping blue sparks, her mouth a compressed, downturned slash of disapproval. Hester walked beside William, making no sound except for the gentle swishing of her skirts in the unkempt grasses.
Hey, you know we're gonna move out here? Oops.
Billy's hat slid off the back of his head when he lifted his face to watch William speak. He grabbed it off the moisture-laden grasses and clumped it back on his head, shoving it down hard with both hands, then jerking on both sides of the brim, enlarging the tear on the left side of the crown.
We have to move on account of Hester being an Injun. You know they killed them all now. Lancaster County don't have any Injuns no more.
Good. You can't trust them.
Emma jerked her right shoulder, walked faster, but kept her peace.
Yeah,
Billy said, nodding his head rapidly, unsettling the loose hat once more. He grabbed it with his right hand, pulled it down over his ears, bobbed his head a few times to ensure a good fit, then walked solemnly ahead, digesting this new way of thinking about them Injuns. When they reached the house, Emma turned to William.
Good day.
William searched Hester's face, but found only hidden eyes beneath lowered lashes.
I'll be on my way then. If you need help, I'll be available. My parents' house is only a few miles across these woods as the crow flies.
Hester lifted her eyes to watch his retreat. She thrilled to the set of the shoulders, the way he loped easily, like a wolf, effortless. Emma fumed and steamed, fussed and stewed, worrying herself to the point of hysteria. She told Hester that man was up to no good, and if she knew her place, she'd have nothing to do with him. Billy said,
"Why not, Ma?"
Hester watched the figure on the horse, a striking rider, disappear into the row of trees. Confusion rode uncomfortably on her shoulders. Well, First things first. Saying nothing, she left Emma and Billy to their own little war of words, slipped through the front door and assessed the damage, the things they'd need. She made a mental list, then returned to the front door, preparing to leave. They did need a man to help them, certainly. Walter Trout was a bit dubious with his weight and all. But Walter proved to be a wonderful help. His face was covered by the wide brim of a straw hat, his thick red suspenders holding up the homespun knee breeches very well, the clean linen shirt bunched over the top of them as he wielded a hammer, pulled a saw, swung an axe. He whistled, sang, or talked, one of the three, all day long. He could only be described as a jolly soul. Hester found him to be a storehouse of amusement. It rolled out of him the way spring water bubbled out of the ground. Spring water was like that. If you tried to stop it, it squirted out the sides stronger than ever. The May sun was warm. It heated the house with its fresh yellow light. Even the dust turned into specks of gold, floating through the air like bits of magic. Hester's hair was covered in an old kerchief, her dress smudged and torn, the gray apron tied about her waist layered with the dust that clung to everything. Walter's whistling was infectious. She began a tune of her own, low, a sort of humming of an old song Kate would sing to the children. She slapped at the low ceiling with her broom, dragging a net of cobwebs with it, blinking and sputtering as chips of old whitewash fell into her eyes. Walter straightened from fixing a hinge on the front door.
Mercy, mercy, child. You're raising more dust than the cavalry marching through town.
Hester laughed, swinging her broom in his direction. You want to do this? Walter's eyes twinkled at her, the good humor crinkling them like a fan closing until they were mere outlines with lashes.
Good to see you so happy, girl. Never saw you with a full-size laugh on your face.
Hester laughed again, which brought tears of joy to Walter's eyes. They repaired, swept, whitewashed, scoured floors, and scrubbed cupboards and closets all through the mellow month of May. Sometimes William King would appear. His offers to help always met with Emma Ferry's icy denial, which riled Billy considerably. He genuinely liked William. Hester wanted him to help, but would not step over the boundaries her benefactor had placed for her. Emma was the authority in her life now, and she respected her requests. William caught her alone, scouring the wide oak planks of the small upstairs. She was whistling softly, the hot water reddening her hands as she worked on the floor with a wooden scrubbing brush. She held completely still when he whispered her name.
Hester.
Yes, William?
Why did you leave the Amish in Berks County? That question haunts me, keeps me awake at night.
It's a long story.
Hester placed the brush in the bucket of water, sat back on the wooden floor, her knees tucked beneath her.
Tell me, please. Emma is outside.
She doesn't like you.
I know. I can't say that I care much for her either.
My story is long, a bit complicated. Annie was not a good companion, as you pointed out to me.
Yes, we are in Die Freundschaft. There is a cruel streak,
William said, saying the words slowly, as if he hand-picked them with great caution.
The situation became unbearable. She didn't like Indians.
Well, I don't either. They're savage. Wild men that deserve to be pushed west where they can live their uncivilized lives, roaming the wilds like the heathens they are.
Hester drew a deep breath to steady herself. Every fiber of her being rebelled against his coarse speech. Was this the same William who held her hand beneath the Amish wedding table? Made her heart beat, sent shivers of joy sluicing through her veins. How could he say these things?
I am an Indian.
Her words were firm, the syllables deliberate, as if she cast them in stone and held them up for him to see.
You may have been born one, but the Amish saved you from being a dirty heathen.
William watched her chest heave with the force of her emotion. He watched as one work-reddened hand went to her apron front to still the upheaval she felt. Her eyes became blacker still, widening with the force of her words.
The Amish had nothing to do with saving me, as you say. Hans Suk and his wife Annie have clabbered my spirit like soured cream, poured me out to soak into the cracks of their parched Berks County earth, leaving nothing but a smelly odor in God's nostrils. William shivered beneath the dark truth in her eyes.
Chapter 10. Walter hired Abe Miller from the ironworking shop to plow a large garden. It was late in the season, but that made no difference to Emma and Hester. They stood side by side in the sweet, violet-laden breezes and watched the shining plow blade turn up the rich black earth in glistening layers, alive with earthworms and grass roots that would serve to soften the ground. An Amish man by the name of Amos Speshear brought wagon loads of manure from his cowshed. Walter decided not to climb up on the wooden bed of the wooden-wheeled wagon because of his age. Emma rolled her eyes and held her hands in front of her own oversized stomach, making meaningful little dips with her eyebrows to show Hester it was his size, not his age. Billy wrinkled his nose, but jumped right up and helped Amos fork the manure onto the harrowed ground. They dragged the harrow through the manure again and again, the sturdy Belgian plodding faithfully, until they had a perfectly prepared plot of soil to raise the vegetables they'd need. They placed onions into rows and sowed tiny carrot seeds in shallow trenches. They planted beans and then prepared poles for them to climb once the bean shoots broke through the soil. One morning, Walter's face became an alarming shade of purple. He spent half the day with his straw hat tipped back, mopping his steaming head with a wrinkled red handkerchief. Emma shook her head at his frequent lapses of effort, her own perspiration running freely down the side of her pink face. She swiped at it with the tip of her apron, discreetly, as if she could hide the fact that she did any sweating at all. Hester heaped the good, loose soil over the seeds, her heart beating strong and sure, the love of the earth infusing her nostrils with a heady scent. She would search the surrounding forest and swamps for the plants in her memory, yarrow and licorice and comfrey, mullein, sorrel, and fennel. She worked ceaselessly, her bare brown feet treading the earth, her spirit soaring with the wings of an eagle. Billy remembered nothing of living in the country before his life with Emma, but the small garden they dug by hand in the town of Lancaster had kept him occupied in spring. The house sat beneath two maple trees, squat and weather-beaten, but as clean as a whistle, windows gleaming, floors smelling of fresh soap and lumber. There was a front porch with a sagging roof that Walter had repaired, balancing his bulk on a seemingly inadequate ladder until even Hester dreaded the approaching accident, which, of course, never occurred. It was just his size, Walter said. When moving day arrived, they hired the same man to drive and haul their possessions out to the homestead, still being careful about Hester's Indian blood. They left the china cupboard and some of the folderols they didn't need. The plank table and straight ladder-backed kitchen chairs fit so nicely by the fireplace, with shelves built along the low kitchen cupboard they brought, that Emma hopped up and down with excitement, spread a clean cloth on the table immediately, and brought out the shtick she had painstakingly prepared for this long-anticipated day. She sliced bread in substantial slices and spread them with pungent yellow butter, freshly churned and packed into a small, shallow crock. She placed thick slices of salty ham on one slice of bread, topped it with more yellow butter and another slice of bread, then arranged the sandwiches on a pewter plate. She fished hard-cooked eggs from the red beet brine that had turned them a delightful shade of red, placed them on a smaller plate with a salt shaker close by, a mound of pickled red beets among the eggs. That done, she set out the square pan of gingerbread, the chilled bowl of clabbered cream to spoon on top, and the biggest treat of all, a sparkling jar of spiced peaches from Helen Dienlinger as a gift in appreciation of their Sunday dinner. It was very nice of Helen to present them with the peaches. Helen's gesture brought great relief to Emma, who had worried about Helen lapsing into heart failure, laced so excruciatingly into her corsets as she was during that Sunday dinner. Emma had given up trying to wear those torture devices as soon as she had snared Enos. Now Emma poured hot tea into earthenware mugs and called Walter, Hester, and Billy to her table. Billy reminded her about the moving man and Amos Speshear,
which sent her immediately to the door, yoo-hooing and making other ridiculous outbursts of sound which served their purpose, bringing both men to the table. Hester kept her eyes lowered, but felt the curious eyes of both men on her face. Amos tried to engage her in conversation, which brought a quick look from the dark eyes, a nod of the head, but a minimum of words. In the late afternoon, lazy white smoke curled up over the stone chimney, the small cooking fire giving away its existence. The fresh white walls were clean and bright, the floors homey with bright rag rugs, the redware and pewter arranged on the shelves in straight, sensible rows so they could be reached efficiently. In the parlor, the corner cupboard stood sentry, a sturdy piece of furniture indispensable to their needs, holding anything from tablecloths and towels to buttons and thread. A few comfortable chairs, one armless, were pulled up to the window. A chest containing blankets and coverlets was pushed against the north wall. The small bedroom along the back was Emma's. The sturdy wooden bedstead was loaded with a straw mattress and feather ticking on top. A tall, handmade closet held her changes of clothes, high-topped shoes, and hats. Emma hung a serviceable white curtain across the window. "You never knew," she said. Billy shared the narrow attic with Hester. They strung a sheet of homespun cloth between them, down the middle of the room for privacy. They set up a narrow rope bed on either side, plus a chest for Hester, and a small wooden box for Billy. A window at each gable end let in sufficient light, but Hester knew the approaching summer would bring the stifling attic heat. First they learned to endure it, and then eventually accepted it as the summer days wore on. Walter pronounced the reclaimed house and garden unbelievable. He praised Emma's work with lovely words of approval, holding his straw hat by the tips of his fingers, his freshly wiped head shining pink in the late afternoon sun. Emma accepted his praise graciously, of course, but the thought ran through her mind that she'd probably like him so much better if he was not quite so pink. But then, bless the man, God had made him so. Or maybe not. All that eating was his own doing. She remained unmoved about Walter Trout, being the stubborn, independent German that she was where men were concerned. Enos had won her heart. But it had taken him a while. Walter had always figured perhaps that was the reason for their childless state. Emma tended to be a bit brittle. Certainly not, though, to the poor and suffering, the orphans and the destitute. To Emma, men were an irritation, mostly. Take that William King, now there was a winner. She'd as soon smack him as talk to him, with his making those sheep's eyes at Hester, his suave good looks and a high-minded attitude that irked her every time he opened his mouth. But if Hester chose to allow him to court her, she'd have to let her go. Walter rode home in the black buggy with the gold pinstripes, pulled by his fine, serviceable horse. He held the reins loosely in his pudgy fingers, his head bowed, the straw hat slightly askew, the breeze flapping up the front brim. Emma Ferry was a hard worker who liked her things in order, but after all these days of labor, which had seemed but one sweet hour of devotion, she had not softened toward him at all. Ah, but wait. Had she made such a fine shtick for only hers and Hester's benefit? He lifted one finger, holding it aloft, as he said out loud, "Now those were the finest, most hearty sandwiches I have ever come across." And who knew? Perhaps the peaches and the gingerbread and the pickled eggs were all prepared with him in mind. No, the battle to win Emma Ferry's heart was indeed not over. Billy was milking the new brown Guernsey cow with Hester giving him instructions. In the adjoining stable, the brown mare gazed at them with her blue-brown eyes, the heavy black lashes blinking slowly as she watched. She was a small horse, but sufficient, Walter had told them, content to let them buy her from him at a low price. Hester finished the milking. Billy stood nearby, flexing his fingers with overly exaggerated motions, his mouth open, his tongue hanging from it like a dog. "That hurts!" Hester laughed. "I used to milk 5 cows at home."
"Don't see how you could."
"You get used to it." Hester straightened, then bent to retrieve the bucket brimming with frothy milk. when the soulful eyes of the brown cow caught sight of Billy's red hair. She kicked out with her right hoof, caught the edge of the wooden pail, and tilted it at an angle, spilling all of the good milk into the straw. Hester shouted, but she was too late. Billy yelled, then bent over double, howling with glee, slapping his legs over and over as tears coursed out of his eyes. The brown cow merely lifted her head, switched her tail from left to right a few times, before placing her cloven hoof in the center of the spilled milk. Wiping his eyes, Billy chuckled the whole way to the house, walking beside Hester, who swung the empty pail by its handle. They worked in the yard that evening, mowing the grass with a scythe, raking it with a wooden rake, and taking it to the barn for the animals. They named the cow Flora, after Billy suggested Kicker or Thumper, laughing uproariously at his own cleverness. The horse they named Frida. Emma said she'd always wanted a daughter named Frida, meaning peace, but she'd never had a daughter until now, and she was already named Hester. She held Hester's hand warmly and thanked her for all the hard work she had done around the place. Hester reminded her that they would not have had to move if she had not come to their house in town. Emma said it was high time Billy got away from that tavern. The coins he hoarded in the tin box weren't worth the danger he put himself in. They slept in their clean new beds that night, the windows opened to the sounds of night insects, the call of the owls, the whippoorwills, and the coyotes. A three-quarter slice of moon bathed the small house in the middle of the clearing in silvery, shimmering light, casting black shadows on the north side and under the maple trees. The rectangular patch of newly planted garden needed a fence, but that would soon be done, Walter promised. An opossum scuttled out from beneath the porch, poked its pointed snout into the ground, shoveled out a few onions, sniffed them, and let them alone. It moved to the barn, snuffling along the walls of the cow stable, its beady eyes taking in the night landscape, digging up tasty grubs along the back wall. Suddenly it stopped. Like a stone, it held still, its nose twitching, then flattened itself against the wall of the shed. A dark figure emerged from the woods, bent over, as if the person were aged or had an arthritic back. The person wasted no time in crossing the field, still crouched but running. The opossum stayed still, watching. The person straightened, flattening himself against the north side of the house where the shadows were thick and black. The moon inched across the sky. A nighthawk screeched his unsettling call. The opossum stayed low against the wall of the shed, scuttled forward, stopped to listen, then disappeared into the thick grass. Still, there was no movement from the deep shadow by the house. In his sleep, Billy coughed softly. He groaned and stretched. The ropes beneath his straw mattress creaked in protest. Hester slept on, deep and dreamless. They discovered a pear tree on the outskirts of the forest. Emma found wild raspberry bushes, then lamented her loss since the fruit had already been eaten by wild creatures.
Hembare! Oh, meine Hembare!
Over and over, she wailed and groaned and recited the recipe for raspberry mush. They found Hula elderberries, but they were not quite the same. Hester spent all her spare time in the garden. The onions popped out of the soil, succulent spears growing an inch every week. The wispy little tops of the carrots grew and sprouted like feather dusters, spreading their lacy tops across the fertile black soil. Red beets grew their tender green leaves, the red spines spread across them like blood veins. Emma cut the beets when they were new and heated them with butter and salt. They ate them with hard-cooked eggs and grated cooked turnips. Hester was in the garden one hot summer day as the afternoon sun was beginning to slide down the bowl of hot, quivering sky. Her hair was a mess. She was overheated, sticky, and a bit disgruntled at Billy's refusal to weed. Emma was too easy on him. She grabbed a stubborn dandelion and yanked, breaking off the root with the snap she knew too well, threw it aside with disgust, and stamped her foot impatiently. A low laugh behind her made her jump. She whirled around, hating to be caught unaware. She always had thoroughly disliked the feeling of being exposed when she should have been able to discern the slightest movement. It was William King. She watched him warily. She felt lightheaded now, the way her pulse fluttered at the base of her neck.
You don't like dandelions?
She did not smile, just shook her head no, evasive, mistrustful.
Why do you dislike me? Am I like the dandelion? A weed that threatens to take over your well-organized life?
I don't dislike you.
Is it Emma?
No.
What is it, Hester?
It's nothing.
I have asked my father permission to court you.
You didn't ask mine.
May I come see you on Sunday evening?
The toe of her right foot shoved into the loose soil. Her head was bent to watch the earth fall away from her toe's movement. I don't know.
What kind of answer is that?
Exactly what I said. I'm not sure.
My father said no.
So why are you asking?
Hester, I have passed my 30th year. It is time I think of taking a wife.
But if your father said no...
I'm past the age where he can dictate my choices.
Hester nodded.
May I come see you?
His voice was warm, eager, kind. His face was open and earnest, his black hair falling on either side, his obedience to the Ordnung so evident. Hester's future stretched before her, an undulating plain of doubt, the road disappearing into a pit of fear and despair. With William, she could find happiness, she believed. They would take their time as they allowed the Amish community to accept their union. But did she truly want to go back? Yes. Stepping forward, he caught her hands and held them to his chest. His blue eyes shone with the intensity of his feelings.
Thank you, Hester. At last I can say those words.
She smiled, a fluttering, shifting stretch of her lips.
I'll tell Emma. Do you want to come with me?
She shook her head. He walked off with an easy, loping gait, swung himself up on the porch, and rapped eagerly on the door. Hester watched as the doors swung inward and the stout form of Emma stepped aside. William bowed slightly, then began to talk. Emma's gaze hung over Hester like a two-edged sword, the way God's word was described in the Bible. She felt as if Emma could see into her very soul and know her past, the part for which she was to blame. Hans might never have had those thoughts and intents if she had been smarter. A dumb Indian. How often had she heard those words? She was dumb, as stump as a rock. She found the German language difficult, but English was like climbing a chalk cliff. And here she was, chasing dumbly after William King. As she thought, Emma moped about the house, then unleashed a fury of words against William King, hurling them into the air so that they smacked against the walls and the sides of Hester's head. Emma held her head and rocked back and forth, then cried copiously into her wide white apron, spluttering and sniffing and saying it was all because she loved Hester more than she knew, and she was so afraid she'd be mistreated by the Amish people. She didn't know these Amish from Adam, and she'd been in a bad situation before. What was Hester thinking?
Oh, du je! Hester, du je! Mein Kind!
A part of Hester wanted to obey Emma's dire warnings. But to live her life here for the rest of her days, never having experienced marriage or having someone close to her heart, without spending life together with a family, was unthinkable as well. Emma, I am not getting married now. I promise to spend only one Sunday evening with him. Only one. If I feel he is not the right man for me, I will end it then. I will. Through her tears, Emma nodded her head, the chin wobbling, her cheeks wet with fresh pathways of more tears, before wiping her face with a white handkerchief. Billy stuck his head in the door and left again, shaking his head and muttering dire predictions about all women. By August, the heat lay so heavy over Lancaster County that the cows stood in any available waterhole to cool themselves down. Heat waves shimmered across the hot earth, pressed down on one's shoulders like a wooden yoke, causing Emma to sit gasping for air, her mouth opening and closing like a bluegill as she waved her apron in front of her face. She sat on an upturned bucket, although very little of it was visible, beneath the still leaves of the maple tree. The air was thick and brassy. The bees droning sounded tired, drained of energy. The cicadas clung to tree bark as they gasped for breath themselves.
Hester! Get out of that garden!
It took all the reserve energy Emma could muster to raise her voice loud enough to yell.
Why? It's too hot!
Hester laughed the sound of a rippling brook, her white teeth flashing in her dark face. She laid down her hoe, lifted her head, and came toward the maple tree. Tall and little, she moved without sound, effortless, her Indian blood enabling her to travel great distances without tiring. Emma never got weary of watching her daughter's graceful, fluid movement. Hester threw herself into the grass at Emma's feet.
I love the garden, Emma.
If you stay out there, you'll melt like a lump of butter.
No.
I wish I had a spring house.
Oh, you should have seen ours in Berks County.
Hester's eyes lit up with enthusiasm as she launched into a vivid account of the wet, cool, dripping stone house Hans had built so cleverly over the cold mountain spring water. Emma watched Hester's face shrewdly, observing the animation. Did Hester miss her home so much? Obviously, there were good memories. There was a time when Hester had been happy, innocent, content.
And my brothers. Remember I told you about Noah and Isaac? They loved to drag a bucket into the cold spring water, run ahead of me on the path I was on, quickly climb a tree, and then dump the cold water all over me.
Hester laughed at the thought, then became closed, pensive. William had taken her to view the Amish community in Lancaster. They rode in his well-made wagon that was comfortable enough for a drive in the warm winds of July. She had been intrigued by the Amish in this area, and interested, but in a half-hearted way, as if she were tasting soup and one important ingredient had been left out, but she didn't care enough to figure out what it was. The farms were prospering, carved out of the woodland by swinging axes that bit into the trees that were sacred to the Indians. They thought that a tree belonged to the Creator and not to any particular person. They couldn't conceive of owning tracts of land, since all the land belonged to the Creator as well. When the white men came and tried to impose their views, many of these peaceful, roaming tribes became furious, marauding in their defense without mercy. Yes, she told William, the Amish and Mennonite settlers were amazing. They had a fierce work ethic. Like Hans, they thrived on hard physical labor. Their goals were to make money, expand, get ahead. They argued that time. He did not back down, but kept his attitude, resolutely holding it within himself by the set of his jaw, the sparkle in his blue eyes a glint of determination. She felt his superiority and her inferiority and inefficiency. Her way of thinking lay fallow. It was dead, old. He had what it would take to get this country going. It was called forging ahead. Chapter 11. That Lancaster County lay directly on unusually fertile soil was evident in the growth of its crops. Its forests were also thick and green and dense, the oaks growing to majestic towers, their thick branches bearing a canopy of leaves so heavy it was like a roof. Amish men cleared the land by the sweat of their brows, side by side with the Mennonites, the Dunkards, and the Quakers, to name several of the plain denominations who had settled in the area. There were Scots, Irish, and English, too, many of them Roman Catholic. Churches sprang up in the town of Lancaster to accommodate the influx of people seeking to make a living on these fertile grounds and needing spiritual sustenance as well. All her life as a child in Berks County, Hester had been used to attending services in Amish homes with a simple meal served afterward. It had seemed odd to skip religious services on Sunday after she came to live with Emma. But because she was afraid to show her face in Emma's church, she simply did not attend any services. She often thought about her childhood, riding to church in the wagon with her siblings. Hans would be practicing his songs the way he always did, with Kate sitting soft and wide beside him, clutching yet another little one on her lap, the large hat pulled well forward past her pleasant face. Going to church was a warm and comfortable ritual, like porridge for breakfast. There was an order to Sunday mornings that began with getting up from her bed in the chilly darkness. Kate would stand so close that Hester could feel her warm breath on the top of her head as she drew the heavy-toothed comb through the snarls in her thick black hair, pulling it so tight her eyes felt slanted like she was from Asia. She had once seen pictures of the Chinese with wide, flat eyes in a book that Theodore Crane, the old schoolteacher, had. In fact, she told Kate that her hair was so tight she was going to turn into an Asian. Kate's soft, rounded stomach had shaken up and down as she laughed quietly. Then she'd held her head against Hester's for an instant and said, "Ah, my dear daughter." That she was loved was never a question. Love had been in abundance in that narrow little log house. It bubbled from rocks in the spring and hovered over the steaming bowls of oatmeal and corn and beans that Kate set on the table. Love was everywhere. In the sky, and the birds, and the distant mountains, the sights that made her heart swell and swell until she had to laugh or cry, she felt so much love. She missed it all now. She sat on a chair she had carried outside, the rough, wide boards covered with a cushion, her bare feet hooked on one of the rungs. Already it was hot as the morning sun climbed into the bold, glaring sky. It was too humid to call the sky blue. Instead, it was white all over, shimmering with heat supplied by the orange sun. In the pasture, the cow stood beneath an oak tree, her tail swishing endlessly back and forth, dislodging troublesome black flies that made her life a misery. The horse, Frida, stamped a front foot, then a hind one, swishing her tail in the same steady rhythm as the cow's. Their heads drooped, as if they already had prepared themselves for the heat of the day. Billy was off somewhere in the woods. Hester knew fishing was forbidden on the Sabbath, so Emma made sure he did not sneak off with his fishing pole. But Hester was almost sure that if she went to the barn to check, the pole wouldn't be there. She smiled. Emma was inside, taking her after-breakfast Sunday morning nap, her bare feet turned up, her ample hands crossed over her stomach, her breaths coming with quick, soft regularity. Her opened Bible lay beside her, a tribute to her Sabbath day's devotion. Hester had read portions of her own Bible as well, but nothing seemed to satisfy her longing for a deeper knowledge of God's will. She skipped over verses, paging through the Old Testament and then the New. She read the words of Jesus, but felt no sense of wonderment. Maybe she was too lethargic to be able to sustain her spiritual body, as if the heat and humidity stifled her desire to learn about God. She reasoned and thought on these things. As she had been raised Amish, the days in her weeks were repetitive, an order to each one. Her clothes portrayed the Ordnung, or rules for living, agreed to by the Amish community. Her cap was a sign of meekness, symbolizing a subservient attitude toward the men in her life, Hans, her father, and if she should marry, her husband. She had stopped wearing her cap. Her hair was now her glory, as the Bible said. Thick and black, it was so straight it resisted combs and hairpins, shining and so glossy it appeared to shimmer with blue. The feeling of being half-dressed had disappeared after a few months, until she felt no need to wear something on her head. William had brought up the subject recently, allowing a sliver of guilt into her conscience. He told her God would not hear her prayers unless her head was covered, since she was a member of the Amish. She had promised to live, stay, and follow Jesus in that church, so who did she think she was? Instantly, rebellion had raised its head, a hooded cobra ready to strike. Angry words filled her mouth, ready to fly forth. Her heart beat heavily, but at the final instant she bit them back, her mouth wide, compressed. She believed William wanted to marry her someday. Why would he be courting her otherwise? Yes, she thrilled to see him. But it was troubling, the instant all-consuming resistance that rose in her when he spoke of so many things. The Ordnung, the Indians, Emma Ferry, almost everything. Maybe the devil had control of her thoughts now that she had made a stand against Hans and Annie. Perhaps that had been all wrong.
Should she have stayed and remained a true and honorable servant all her life? For now, she was of the world. She was worldly. It was hard to always know if you were doing the right thing. Had she picked up the heathen ways of the Indians, as William had said? But they were not heathen. They weren't. Would she say one thing and mean another all her life? Oh, she'd stood up to William when his voice brought the usual uprising, the resistance that filled her. She'd told him how she felt about Hans and Annie, but what did she really believe about them? And what was right for her to do? She leaned forward and dropped her dark head in her hands. She felt as if she were being torn in two directions. Two sides were pulling her in opposite ways, upsetting the peace and stability of her life with Emma and Billy. She heard a sound that was not a bird song. It was a bit liquid and trilling, like the sound of birds, but wait a minute. Up came her head. She held so still she seemed built into the chair. Unmistakably, the whistle held a tune. Lightly, but it was there. Now she heard the chirring of a gray squirrel, the call of the meadowlark she could see plainly perched on the rail fence. There it was again. Someone, somewhere, was whistling. Rapt, she remained seated, her senses keen, expecting the whistling to come closer. Instead, it faded away, leaving her feeling deprived, as if a wonder had occurred but been taken away before she could grasp it. The feeling of melancholy, a lowering of her spirits, remained the rest of the day, until she realized it was almost time to prepare for William's visit. Emma made no pretense about hiding her displeasure. She told Hester outright that she had no time for William King, but if she insisted on letting him court her, then she would stay out of the way. Hester eyed Emma from her place at the oval mirror above the washstand. Small and round as she was, her face beat red with indignation, bristling with disapproval and something else. She wound her hair into a loose twist, held it fast with sturdy pins and combs, then turned to Emma, her eyes large and dark. She had no idea how beautiful she was, how pure and unspoiled. A magnolia in the midst of dandelions, Emma mused. "Why do you dislike William so?" Hester asked breathlessly. "I just do. I'm sorry if you feel bad about me spending the evening with him, but just let me try, all right?" Emma's answer was a significant whoosh of forced air through her nostrils, a sharp turning on her heel, with her wide back floating across the room and out the front door, leaving the room empty of a spoken statement. Hester felt as if she were violating Emma's goodness of heart. How could she be so set in her mind? Emma was the angelic figure who rescued poor children, wet dogs, and injured cats, who handed out food and money to dubious, bedraggled recipients who, more than likely, were not worthy of her generosity, spending it on cheap apple whiskey or frittering it away on senseless sins of a different nature. William arrived in his shining wagon, the lap robe tucked beneath the seat, the horse black, his neck arched and his tail flowing, pawing the ground impatiently. Hester's heart fluttered as if a canary were caged inside her chest. A high song of happiness propelled her down the steps and out through the short grass surrounding the house. His eyes found hers and stayed on them. He drank in the caramel color of her fine, glowing skin, the black liquid stars that were her eyes, and vowed to himself that he would make her his wife. He would rescue her from the heathen nature of her origin and pull her out of the quicksand Emma Ferry had set for her. Love beat strongly in his breast. He marveled that God allowed this wonderful creature, this child of sweetness and innocence, into his life. That outburst about Hans and Annie had been all Emma Ferry's poison, not Hester's own thinking. Secure in the knowledge of his own intelligence, William lifted the reins and they were off in a cloud of heat and dust. Behind them, a florid, sweating face peered around the corner of the brown house, and an arm was flung angrily in their direction. Her small feet carried Emma into the house, where she cut herself a wide wedge of custard pie, followed by another as large as the first, before she looked at the clock and wondered where that Billy was. It was getting late. The wagon wheels made very little sound as they followed the country road away from the house.
The magnificent horse trotted smoothly, its black mane flowing in the breeze. William's hands were strong and brown, with long, thick fingers holding the reins easily, skilled at the art of driving a fine horse. His profile was so handsome. His yellow straw hat set square and low on his forehead, the way she remembered Hans's. He was kind and attentive, pointing out the Amish farms that dotted the cleared fields. The farm belonging to his parents, Elias and Francis King, had a stone house so much like her own in Berks County that she gasped. It was almost identical, including the grayish color of the limestone. The windows were few, tall, and paned with many separate pieces of glass. The wooden sashes could be raised and lowered, allowing for breezes when the weather was warm and protection against cold winds and snow. The barn was built along the side of a hill, allowing easy access to the second floor. The animals were housed snugly against winter's frigid winds on the first floor. A vast orchard lay to the south, with apple and peach and cherry trees, sentinels of hard work and excellent management skills. The corn was tall and heavy, a deep green color that spoke well of Elias King's farming know-how. Hester imagined the hayloft bursting with mounds of loose hay and straw, the corn crib full. Her heart beat firmly and steadily. Here in this fertile soil was her destiny. Here she could work tirelessly side by side with her handsome William. Finally, she would be free of the creeping certainty that she was no one, always hunted because of the color of her skin. The Amish were held in high esteem, hard workers that tilled the land, and she would be one of them. If William King wanted her for his wife, the Amish would come to accept her in time. She would prepare herself for the ridicule, which was as sure to come as rain. It was the nature of men, just as certain as the changing of seasons or the lightning that occurred by the powers of God. But she would belong. She would etch out a place for herself as William King's wife. Respect and honor would follow. She would bake the lightest bread and the sweetest pies. Her garden would yield vast quantities of vegetables, enough to share with the neighbors. Like Kate's, the wooden cradle would always hold an infant. Hester glanced sideways at William, noticing the neat angle of his nose, the perfect jaw, the set of his mouth.
"Here, Hester, is what I will inherit."
William waved a hand in the general direction of his parents' farm. Hester's large eyes were round with awe.
"Of course, my father and mother will live in the Dotty house on the same yard, but I believe in time my mother will come to accept you. She can teach you how to work."
"I know how to work. I was taught first by Kate, then by Annie. I doubt very much whether your mother knows more than I do."
"Oh, the voice of inexperience, Hester. My mother is held in high esteem all through the valley. She is unequaled in just about every housekeeping skill. She makes her own pawn house at butchering time, saying no one else is as fit."
William laughed, a superior sound of exulting that eclipsed Hester's happiness and her plans for the future, turning her awe of the beautiful farm to a gray hue of uncertainty. Hester fell silent after that laugh. William told her he would not introduce her to his parents just yet, adding that it would be nice if he had a magic potion that would turn her skin white like his. Hester smiled, but it was a mere lifting of the corners of her mouth, a small, trembling mock of gaiety. He stopped the horse by a tumbling brook, then turned to her in the glow of the evening light beneath a canopy of green leaves that made a soft rustling sound, as if they were settling themselves for the night. Somewhere, a robin set up a short, raucous bedtime call, gathering her fledglings in. He let the reins dangle at his feet after loosening the horse's neck rein, allowing him to lower his head and pull at the thick green grass.
"Hester, I have loved you since I first saw you. So shy, so set apart among a group of girls at that wedding. I have never forgotten you. You have remained in my heart and in my mind. It is only by God's grace that he allowed you back into my life. I know this is very soon, but I hope to marry you by November."
"But..." Hester was completely taken aback.
William held up a hand. "No, don't protest. I know I'm moving too fast. I love you, Hester. My love for you is a beacon of hope I carry in my heart. I want you for my wife. My mother needs to have me marry now.
Suddenly she was caught in his arms, held against him in a vice-like grip. Clumsily, his lips sought hers, then found them. Hester had never been kissed. It was so sudden, so powerful, she had no time to resist, to attempt to loosen herself from his grip. When she thought perhaps she would suffocate after all, he